count to 20.
So what tall zone, he shoot up a school, chanel, so nail, school, sat to tall the joker do nigger do, she got do the lad of a squad and they lad of son, they lad of tall school.
Bear.
Yona.
Deer.
Ahoy.
Coon.
Kahla.
Squirrel.
Saloli.
Buffalo.
Yansan.
Fish.
Ajati.
Mud turtle.
Shaligugi.
Fox.
Juhula.
Wolf.
Wahya.
Horse.
Sawili.
Cow.
Swaka.
Hog.
Sikwa.
Cat.
Wesha.
Dog.
Geely.
Chicken.
Chitaga.
Mule.
Tigalina Hida.
Basket.
Taluja.
Corn sifting basket.
Gangusti.
Mortar, the bottom part you use for grinding corn.
Kanona.
And the pestle.
Stosti.
Ball stick.
Tilaskalti.
Ball.
Alaskalti.
Mask.
Agandula.
Bow.
Kalsadi.
Arrow.
Tigadalada.
Blowgun.
Tugwesti.
Ammunition.
Kani.
Gun.
Kalogwe.
Monday.
Undargwanahi.
Tuesday.
Talinaiga.
Wednesday.
Soinaiga.
Thursday.
Nakinaiga.
Friday.
Junki Losti.
Saturday.
Undargwidana.
Sunday.
Undargwaskai.
House.
Kasode.
Roof.
Kasanali.
Fire.
Atsila.
Corn.
Selu.
Corn cob.
Selu uta.
Corn husk. Corn husk.
Unu lotanahi.
Corn meal.
Selu uta.
Bean.
Tuyahi.
Squash. Pumpkin.
Hiya.
Gourds.
Wagigu.
Bread.
Gatuhi.
Lard, grease.
Goi.
Meat.
Hawiya.
Sugar.
Kalsaji.
Salt.
Ama.
Water.
Ama.
Apple.
Sankta.
Peach.
Kwanan.
Cherokee.
Chalagi.
Indian.
Yawayahi.
Man.
Askaya.
Woman.
Agehya.
White person.
Yunega.
Tobacco.
Chola.
Cigarette.
Tigoksti.
Snuff.
Cholwangei.
East.
Kalangui.
West.
Udali Gui.
North.
Juya Jai.
South.
Jugana Wai.
Up.
Kalaldi.
Down.
Elati.
Hello.
See you. See you. See you. See you.
How are you?
Tahui Guja. Tahui Guja. Tahui Guja.
Fine.
Oxigo. Oxigo. Oxigo.
Yes.
Mm.
No.
Slano. Slano. Slano.
Where are you going?
Gajan Huikti. Gajan Huikti. Gajan Huikti.
Huh? I'm going to town.
The God to whom would you got thing? The God to whom would you got thing? The God to whom would you got thing?
Where's he going?
God's in work thing. God's in work thing. God's in work thing.
He's going to town.
The God to whom work thing? The God to whom work thing? The God to whom work thing?
He went to town yesterday.
The God to whom went and sent us sahi. The God to whom went and sent us sahi. The God to whom went and sent us sahi.
He's going to town tomorrow.
The God to whom the yes and I lay in. The God to whom the yes and I lay in. The God to whom the yes and I lay in.
What's your name?
Though that's a don't un. Though that's a don't un. Though that's a don't un.
My name's Jonah.
Jonah, that would don't un. Jonah, that would don't un. Jonah, that would don't un.
What's his name?
Gado do don't un. Gado do don't un. Gado do don't un.
His name's Jonah.
Jonah do don't un. Johnny do don't un. Johnny do don't un.
What's her name?
Gado do don't un. Gado do don't un. Gado do don't un.
Where do you live?
Gaza de Jana. Gaza de Jana. Gaza de Jana.
Where does he live?
Gaza Chiwena. Gaza Chiwena. Gaza Chiwena.
Where do they live?
Gaza Chunena. Gaza Chunena. Gaza Chunena.
I live at Big Cove.
Call a night to get on. Call a night to get on. Call a night to get on.
He lives at Big Cove.
Call a night to Wayne. Call a night to Wayne. Call a night to Wayne.
They live at Big Cove.
Call a night to Nana. Call a night to Nana. Call a night to Nana.
What do you want?
Do you seduce her? Do you seduce her? Do you seduce her?
What does he want?
Do you seduce her? Do you seduce her? Do you seduce her?
What do they want?
Do you seduce her? Do you seduce her?
I want some flour, and some lard, and some bacon, and some coffee.
Who's the last day I would do, Lehan? Going no. How we are no. Who's the last day I would do, Lehan? Going no. How we are no. Uja les de agua du liha. Going no. How we are no.
How much is all that? How much does that cost?
And got a god to the girl was thing. And got a god to the girl was thing. And got a god to the girl was thing.
That's $5.
He's got a lahi. He's got a lahi. He's got a lahi.
That's $2.50.
Tal de la yehling. Tal de la yehling. Tal de la yehling.
Thank you.
Gaya le li ching. Gaya le li ching. Gaya le li ching.
When will you be back?
Lai yutan hi lu ching. Lai yutan hi lu ching. Lai yutan hi lu ching.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Sinalayin hi gong gong hin. Sinalayin hi gong gong hin. Sinalayin hi gong gong hin.
I'll see you next week.
So what the land hi gong gong hin. So what the land hi gong gong hin. So what the land hi gong gong hin.
I saw him yesterday.
Oof, so he's he gong again. Oof, so he's he gong again. Oof, so he's he gong again.
I'll see him tomorrow.
Sinale and see gong again. Sinale, yet see gong again. Sinale, yet see gong again.
I'm going now.
No, don't get seen. No, don't get seen. No, but don't get seen.
He's going now.
No, but don't get seen. No, but don't get seen. No, but don't get seen.
I went yesterday.
Usha, I went and sang again. Usha, I went and sang again. Usha, I went and sang again.
He went yesterday.
Usha, I went and sang again. Usha, you went and sang again. Usha, you went and sang again.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye. Kano go kadana ista kaya wela ne tika yoshi hi ase nusti ini o yahi ini hui asta yi gana tikina tolisti tikina dage yuhi tsuge sangi igini yahu sehavuni gana wasti talas go to dehti yanda tikini lohsan tsuwi ni luhki tsutina lehni san Naski yaji ni ktahi achi ni ginal chi ni gini wese kalankuti. Haan tata gan yi shige yuhi yu nulis tanayin. Hine li yana cha daan tanayin. Aya ye nohi achi ni gan wese ha. Hi ktahi nukstan ke anayin. Kila kalay ni shin kalli cha tohonski. Hiski dini yoli aneha digil cho taan. Dige lasti. Asi no. Uyoku iyako tehna teki, aki nekan naiku, aseski nino ansa, tsukan ulohti akkaan skiikin. Hi askini te jito liikan, tini ja uusi, ele tsunih tsanki, ele tini ka jala. Tuni jo siha kaatuhi, ele kano heta, maski no te jivohta hitoha, kano heta te jineha. Kaatuhi ele ateela, aki nikita joukon. Hik tahapu aja, tekin taun anna tiska anna jouneika. Tsukun ulohti anna vahtiskai. A jähli iju kotiinata na aai. Tsukun ulohti aja liika aja kinituhai. A sivuno tuni jousi anna jouujahi. A seno uutuki tsiijanska itse ugaujuhi. Kini kaha naski ika ugo wahta di. Aya jouni tissa teski ko wela ka kenge yui unela nuutasteela.
They certainly have depressive feelings according to the information which I think Halliwell gives out. So the same kind of situation, that is where hostility is under great control and where its expression would be guilt, open expression would be guilt inducing. Then to express it in fantasy invokes guilt feelings. Guilt feelings have their own tension again. They must be discharged. They can be discharged by taking the aggression on the self and either actually doing something which will further defeat one's self-esteem, By failing in something or something of this nature, or by simply being depressed and verbally reducing your self-esteem. That is, depressed people, unlike people who act out their self-punitive tendencies, like the Raskolnikov idea, where one contrives to get caught, or the people who call up police stations after somebody has been murdered and confess that they did it, rather than act out this way, the depressed person is somebody who verbally punishes himself. He doesn't contrive to let other people do it, but he does it by verbalization, internal verbalization. I'm bad, I'm worthless, I'm no good. In other words, he's administering himself a verbal punishment. And in this sense, then, one can see that he takes really the position of the parental figure, who, as he fantasies, would have administered the same kind of verbal punishment to him. And we can only speculate here about places where the discipline and punishment is done largely by words, as against where it's done largely by corporal punishment. The difference this makes in terms of whether one punishes oneself verbally or whether one contrives to get punished physically in terms of the acting out. That is, I'm only throwing this out, and I have no data to support it, but it just occurs to me that certainly this is a possibility. Well, so then, we find that this is the situation, that depression means internalized verbal punishment. That is to say, internalized aggression. Aggression directed against the self. Punishments directed toward verbal depreciations of self-esteem. Now, how does this situation evolve? Well, we have to postulate that most depressive, ready people are pretty sensitive people to being approved. That is to say, they're always ready to feel themselves being unapproved, and therefore they need a good deal of real demonstration of approval from the world outside. And when this isn't forthcoming to support them, then any little insult may very well touch off the whole verbal punishment idea. I am bad, I am worthless, nobody loves me, I am disapproved, and I disapprove myself. And hence, therefore, there is always something in the present which touches this off. But the important thing, however, is that we would have to assume that depressive reactions, on the one hand, have to be engendered by early experiences in the withholding of aggression and later of verbally punishing the self for being unworthy and for being aggressive. That is to say, is what it really implies. So that this is a depressive position. Now, another added factor gets in here, however, and that is that it is only if one has had a rather severe discipline at the same time with a good deal of anxiety about the relationship, so that the individual had to hold to the relationship in spite of the discipline, that can set the stage for this kind of internalized superego, which is going to make somebody feel depressed. That is to say, you have to postulate, first of all, someone who makes the child, in this early sense, anxious, and yet whom the child has to have, and who therefore is severe, but who cannot be avoided by the child, and who asks the child to give up his hostility because otherwise he will not be loved. Now, where you do not get this kind of transaction so intensely as you do in our culture, for example, then you can expect that on this basis alone, the depressive reaction will be much less severe. Now, another kind of situation you find creating depressive reaction is this, that the individual, and this is only a variant on the theme, behaves as if somebody has said to him, you've been bad and I don't like you. And this is the same kind of thing. He takes it and punishes himself. I mean, this is only another approach to this, but you frequently see an actual childhood prototype of this where the parent actually does punish the child and say to the child, I don't like you, you go away from me, you leave, you stand in the corner, or you take yourself out of my sight for a while and you lose me for a while. And then the child feels bad, cannot have his hostility even about this, and so then feels alone, depressed, unwanted. Now, in order to understand suicide, we have to postulate increasing aggression about this, and that is that we must assume that the child in some cases gets so very aggressive against this disciplinary and yet indispensable figure, which is then generalized onto other figures in the world, that the hostility is so severe about the disappointment from this person who makes him give up his hostility, makes him perform so rigidly, that this kind of issue could say, I could kill this person. But obviously, since this is the forbidden expression of hostility, then it's put to the self and I will kill myself. Now, I suspect that almost every suicide is overdetermined. That is to say that it isn't only just in the pursuit of real hostility that people kill themselves, although I may only ask you to think about the various ways in which people commit suicide as evidences of how different the hostility is. There are people who shoot themselves, there are people who cut themselves, who hang themselves, there are people who simply lie down and go to sleep via the barbiturates, or people who simply throw themselves out of a building or over a bridge and drown. And that this all must have something to do with indices of how much aggression is expressed in this kind of act. And here again, we have, this of course, as you can see, would be very nicely culturally determined, as we know, not only in the sense, let us say, of the way the culture evokes aggression and how much hostility in these people, but also in the very methods by which the culture allows suicide to happen. That is, obviously, you couldn't commit death by barbiturate intoxication until after 1865 or so, when we had barbiturates. But before that time, one took poison, arsenic, for example, or strychnine, or something of some very interesting poison, which, of course, led to a lot of very poor jokes, like the one about the excited young drug clerker rushes in and says to the old man, the proprietor of the drugstore, there's a Scotchman out here who wants 10 cents worth of poison to commit suicide. How can I stop him? And the proprietor says, charge him 15 cents. Well, of course. But at least these variations in the method of committing suicide are quite great. Well, now, the essential thing here, however, I think, is to see that it takes a very severe disciplinary and rather, let us say, unitary source to create the depressive position. That is to say, it has to be, this usually occurs in a very intense relationship around one person who holds the individual very strictly to performance levels of aspiration, who very severely inhibits any expression of hostility on the basis of the fear and threat of removing love, and that therefore, in this situation, you can expect high depressive reactions and high suicidal rates engendered by this kind of maneuver. So that, therefore, where this does not happen, then you would not expect the intense depressive reaction. Now, I might say that in terms of the one other thing, of the obsessive-compulsive character, because again, we do not find very much obsessive-compulsive character in pre-literate society. That is, you find them, but they are not the frequent expressions. And here again, the obsessive-compulsive character, as we know, is an individual who, like many of us, has bound his hostility very tightly so that he is able to handle it without too much knowledge of how hostile he is. And therefore, as long as his defenses work, he doesn't get depressed. Now, it goes something like this again, that I am asked to give up my hostility, but I have high hostility because of the depriving source, and mothers of obsessive-compulsive children are not ordinarily very good mothers. They're very strict mothers, again, something like the depressive position. And the individual then tries to be very good as a reaction formation. He may then expend his hostility in character formations, that is, by being very orderly to the point of actually expressing a good deal of hostility by his slowness and his meticulousness and the way he holds people up and so on. So that in this setting, then, you find that there's a good deal of hostility in these people, and they do not relate very well because of the hostility. And you find that the proof of this, of course, is that if you try to do psychotherapy with such people, they slow you down a good deal, because as soon as you get a relationship established with them where they can really afford to express hostility, then they are depressed afterwards, because the hostility has escaped from control, and you have 2 or 3 weeks where you can do nothing but support, and then you attack the defenses again a little bit, more hostility, and then you slow down again because of the depressive sequelae. So that it's strung out a long time in terms of therapy. But the important thing, however, is that, again, these are people whose interpersonal reactions are very definitely bound up in a highly ambivalent relationship with a very few people, that is to say, most particularly with mother in the beginning, and in a very tense relationship where, again, hostility was not allowed expression, and where there were no other possibilities for expressing it. Now, of course, our culture does recognize that there needs to be expressions for hostility, and we allow in games, for example, children to play a cowboy and Indian. We also have some games during the so-called latency period when we impress a little bit more control upon hostility than we put upon the 4 or 5 year old child. And it's interesting that these games are all very carefully, have very careful rules in them. That is to say, it's almost like the externalization of the obsessive-compulsive idea that you can express a good deal of aggression. For example, take boxing. You can express a lot of aggression in boxing, but you have to abide by the rules. And of course, war is on a grander scale, not too much different. That is to say, where hostility is allowed to find its expression, it has to be pretty well ruled so that at least one has the impression that it's safe and that nothing is just a pure, impulsive, spontaneous act, that everything is bound by ritual. And hence, again, we do make some provisions for this. And then, of course, comic books about which so much war has raged in psychiatric and other circles also provide, for especially in the pre-pubertal period, when we have a good deal of hostility being reactivated over what is my role and am I going to be loved in all of the earlier conflicts, these comic magazines with their hostility and sexuality and so on are fantasy material, which who knows, may be at least partially valuable in terms of providing the opportunity to fantasy out these conflicts. Now, obviously, there are some people, the creative people, who prefer to do it alone, and that's all very well. I mean, they provide the comic books. Well, so this situation, then, in terms of the obsessive-compulsive character. Now, I would only like to say maybe a few words again about paranoia and the paranoid character and projection, because I'm going to talk a little bit more about this in terms of the epidemiology, let us say, of mental disease and some future lecture. But I only want to call your attention to the reciprocal and facilitating, shall we say, mutually enforcing relationship of hostility and projection. For example, I said that one of the things you find in the attribution of, like, if one has high hostility oneself and doesn't use it depressively, that is to say, but uses it projectively. And I may say to you that this is very interesting, because we know from our study of the psychopathologic person that the individual who succeeds in projecting his hostility escapes from being depressed. The individual who cannot do this is depressed. And frequently you find that the prodromal period of a paranoid schizophrenic episode is a long period of depression, where the individual works as if he is bad, and then he succeeds in projecting and says, they hate me, therefore now I can hate them with impunity, because they are calling me names and criticizing myself like, not, they don't know this, like I would criticize myself. In other words, the depressive person criticizes himself intrapsychically and accepts the blame. The paranoid individual projects the self-criticism outside and acts as if the other person is criticizing him, and doesn't recognize that it is his own criticism being projected, you see? Well, now, the nice way that this gets mutually facilitated is this. That after all, let's put things on the rather more positive side. We all want to love one another. That is just as much as we want to hate one another. We want to love one another, because dependency, gratifications, the need to use other people for satisfactions came first, after all, in terms of Genesis. And the reason why we can't love each other is because we have so much hostility for each other. Well, now, one of the ways to really get to know people, of course, is to have some love for them. If you have high hatred for people, you never get to know them. If you never get to know them, you have no corrective on what they really are and what they're really thinking. Therefore, your projection works very well, because your hostility keeps you from knowing that your projection is untrue. And so, therefore, this thing feeds itself. As soon as I can make my projection, I make it only because I've had hostility toward people all along anyway, and have never had any very satisfactory intimacy with people, so that I really know how another person is. And therefore, now that I really have projected my hostility, then, of course, I don't have to know them anymore, and I can make them behave as I need to have them behave as criticizers of me by my projection. And so this very question of isolation, you see, which keeps the paranoid individual or the paranoid character from really seeing that his projections are wrong, it gets to be an impossible situation unless somehow you can help him reduce the hostility and relate to the other person to see how the other person really thinks, and not how he anticipatorily is behaving that they do think. So that these things feed into one another. As a matter of fact, you find, for example, in war prisoners who are speech isolated, that very frequently they develop paranoia, temporarily, only while they're in prison. Because again, you see, they do not know what the other people are thinking. And hence, they cannot relate to them, and so they very easily take the projection. They must be thinking my thoughts. That is to say, they're thinking my criticism of myself. Therefore, they hate me, because I hate myself, because of my hostility and my own learning about myself in relation to others. Because you have to remember that the very hostile person has a very low opinion of himself, because although he says, I hate people, still he also has, in his conception of himself, developed the idea, I am somebody who is hated, because this has been his experience. And so therefore, unless one can really sense the great loss of self-esteem involved in these people, then it isn't you sort of miss the boat by counter-hostility. Well, in this sense then, you have this projection which enforces the situation. Now, obviously, this is very relevant for considerations of magic and sorcery. Magic has condensed within it the ambivalence that's in interpersonal relationships. It has the productive aspect and the destructive aspect. And so it can be an anxiety reducer in terms of facilitating gratification. It can be a tension reducer in terms of facilitating hostility. And so that, again, the whether or not there is overt aggression in a society, and what correlation the amount of aggression, overt aggression, has with the amount of sorcery is practiced is something that you as anthropologists can answer much more adequately than I. But certainly sorcery is one of the very good ways for the expression of hostility. And obviously its danger is, that is to say, so far as it is, its danger is not only that it can be used by the individual who projects, but the other individual who is going to be the victim also projects his own expectancies of the hate into the aggressor. And so the whole thing facilitates itself very nicely again. That is to say, as we know, and as Dr. Linton suggested in his last lecture, which phobia is much more important than witchcraft, perhaps, in terms of the efficacy of the witchcraft. That is to say, the other individual behaves as if, there's no question but that, he should be killed. And moreover, I mean, one of the the way this works out very nicely, I think, was illustrated in Halliwell's study of the Barrens Indians. He talks about the one Barrens River Indian who came upon the trap of one of the I guess it was the Sand Lake tribe or some other neighboring tribe of Indians. And the trap was open. So as a joke, but with intent, the one Indian defecated in the trap and left some of the feces sticking out of the trap. Well now, of course, this brings to mind again the anal sadistic conceptions, how you use the early habits as an expression of hostility. But I may say here, well, this is an interesting thing, I must come back to it. The conception here that I wanted to bring out, however, was, all right, this is an act of great aggression, and moreover, in terms of the subsistence needs of the Indians, rather a serious one, too, because of interference with food supply and so on. So it wasn't just a harmless prank, we would take it. And, of course, after this act of aggression, then later, this man is described as dreaming that a conjurer from the other tribe had tried to kill him. In other words, you see, that in his dream, he had already paid his own penalty. That is, in other words, he reproached himself for his act of aggression and anticipated the retribution. And this was all done intrapsychically. So that it shows again this nice interplay between and use of the projective mechanism. And what I wanted to say about the anal sadistic acts is that obviously, again, those who are over-enthusiastic perhaps about seeing everything as a regressive behavior and missing entirely the implication that the regressive behavior is used in the present for present motivational purposes, this whole question about incontinence in the psychopathologic people, as frequently we know, there are some schizophrenics who defecate and urinate without the proper time and place. And it's all very well, we can say, well, this individual just regressed and he's gone back into his childhood, and there he is now, just before sphincter control was established in this pre-Puritan morality period, and quite free. Well, obviously, this is only part of the story. If one really scrutinizes this incontinent behavior, you see very definitely that this schizophrenic uses this behavior to gain certain present ends. That is to say, to express aggression, hostility, and various other emotions in the present. So that it isn't only now going back and regressively expressing it in fantasy, it's actually using this earlier habit for present purposes. As a matter of fact, what one finds, I may say, in most of these incontinent people is that they are not totally incontinent in the sense in which the neurological patient, for example, is, who doesn't have any sphincter control. They only put out small amounts at a time. They save it, so to speak, so that they have chronic ammunition during the day. And so this indicates, again, the very purpose of nature of this regressive behavior. In other words, it isn't it's regressive only in its content. Its dynamic meaning is not regressive at all. It's quite in the present as a way of expressing things to people. Well, so these things. Now, there's one other thing that I'd like to talk about very briefly, and that is, I think, was covered quite adequately by Dr. Linton, and I only bring it in here for sake of completeness. And that is the question of the relationship of hostility and humor. Now, obviously, humor serves a great many purposes, and I have no desire here to elaborate on the psychology of laughter. Obviously, the laughter is, I'd have you think only for a moment about something about the relationship of the joke and the dream. They are not too far apart, you know. The joke makes use of the same kinds of mechanisms the dream makes use of, condensation, symbolization. It's not as covert and as hidden as the dream. It's much more open. It has to be, because it has to be communicative. But it has somewhat of the same playfulness and the same pre-logical quality of the dream. And therefore, it's used as a bypass for both libidinal gratification and for hostility expression. That is to say, obviously, the jokes that people tell determine their character a good deal. For example, in our society, you will note, you can count on the fingers of one hand how many homosexual jokes you have been told. They're extraordinarily rare, because homosexuality has such high anxiety value in this culture that it cannot be retailed in a joke. You have to dream that. But the situation, however, in the more heterosexual jokes are that you engage the individual for a moment in the play of the joke, and the ordinary inhibitions are relaxed, and then the forbidden anxiety-evoking material comes out, and the anxiety is discharged in laughter, and one has had one cake and eaten it too. Now, in hostility, of course, obviously the tendentious wit is well known. These joking relationships which cover over the hostile intent, I mean, well-known phrase, when you call me that, smile, all disclaiming techniques. Some of the subarctic Indians, for example, have a joking relationship to the old people in the tribe, who are useless and no longer capable of supporting themselves, and are a great drain on the young people who have to have a difficult time of subsistence. So the hostile intent, which is covered over by humor, is certainly an important factor there. So that a good deal of hostility gets expressed this way. For example, in our own culture, we use the joke to express hostility, and you can almost take the, you can certainly see the cultural bindingness of the joke. For example, one of the jokes that was quite current during the beginning of the war was, as you know, jokes about England. One of them I remember quite definitely was that the an Englishman and an American, a Frenchman and an Australian were flying in a plane, and the wings began to ice. And the pilot came back and said, "I'm sorry, we're losing altitude. One of you will have to jump out. It's the only way that we can maintain our position." So the American said, "I'll volunteer," and stopped, and "God bless America," and jumped overboard. And they went on, but the plane still lost weight. The pilot comes back, says, "One more has to go." So this time the Frenchman volunteer jumps up, Vive la France, and jumps over. So it was fine. That left only the Englishman and the Australian. But the plane still kept losing weight. The pilot comes back and, "I'm sorry, but one of you gentlemen will have to go." And the Englishman stood up and said, "There'll always be an England," and pushed over the Australian. Well, the situation there, obviously, the hostility which directed nationally, another way of getting this out. And one of the techniques, incidentally, not only is there a kind of, let us say, discharge of hostility toward a displaced object, but also you will note that the situation, interpersonal situation, where the individual frequently tells a joke because he senses the hostility of the audience, and it's as if somehow he has to discharge this hostility by the joking maneuver. That is, for example, that's one of my techniques, you understand. But when I speak to certain groups, lay groups particularly, who I know have certain feelings of hostility, albeit they may be mixed, there may be a little, mighty little, mostly hostility towards the psychiatrist, I usually begin by telling a joke against myself. In other words, you see, I discharge the hostility about me by my own maneuver. This is much safer, of course. You have it under your control. And the result is that there is a good deal then of discharge of hostility and a conjoiningness in the group that one doesn't get before. So that this certainly is one of these very frequent ways of technique. Well, I think perhaps I don't know now, it's about 9, is it?
It's about 8 after 9.
Well, perhaps I would stop here and allow then the time for the rest of the discussion. You know, incidentally, I mean, Freud was very much concerned about collecting jokes, and he particularly liked to collect Jewish jokes, and particularly those which were expressed hostility toward Jews. And this was a considerable concern to him, as you know, because he felt the minority situation very keenly. One of these jokes, I remember, I may tell you here without any offense, it simply indicates the dynamics of humor and aggression toward the minority group. But the story that Freud has in his collection was that a Jewish gentleman was out of work and decided in desperation to apply for a job to the mother superior of a nunnery. And so he went there and he was given the job, and with the condition, however, that he would be on probation for the first week. So he worked, as he thought, fairly diligently. At the end of the first week, the mother superior came to him and said, "Well, now, really, you're doing fairly well." She said, "You know, I don't mind you lighting your cigarettes from the holy candles, and I don't even mind you washing your hands in the holy water. But I do wish you would stop calling me Mother Shapiro." But you see, the idea of being there. Yes.
In the definition of masochism and sadism, where is the barrier and the goal in the case of masochism?
Yeah, well, masochism has been described something like this, that the individual has been punished for certain libidinal gratifications and libidinal seekings. Now, the person who punishes is the barrier. That is to say, in this case, it's the, let us say, maybe the father. This fits analytic theory better, you understand. And now, however, for the reasons that one cannot express hostility towards such a figure, then one learns that you're punished for bad things, you see. So therefore, the conception is that if I punish myself, I will satisfy the claims of father, and then I can do this thing that I am about to do. And this would be somewhat the maneuver. Now, this, of course, has a little bit, there's a little difficulty in all this business about masochism, you understand. That requires a little, psychologically, it's a little difficult to bring off. Now, if you read, if you read Ford and Beach's book on sexual patterns and culture, they make a quite acceptable hypothesis there about how physical assault and aggression get fused with sexuality, by pointing to the fact that in those cultures where sexual assault and aggression are permissive and sexual advances are also permissive, then the boys and girls learn that starting with aggressive play, it's also possible to go then over to sexual play, so that the two businesses of being sexually assaulted, so to speak, get fused. That is to say, physical aggression and sexuality as a gratification get fused, because there's an opportunity to learn both at the same time. Now, in cultures where these have to be kept apart, as for example, largely in our culture, then of course you do get this split that I talked about one time before between tenderness and sexuality. That is to say, if my learning has been that the tenderness or the love relationship of the woman has to be an aggressively and sexually restricted one, well, then I may have also the learning that sexuality is an aggressive act, and therefore I cannot be aggressive toward this love object because it's too dangerous. So therefore, this may lead to impotency on one hand if I try with such a love person, but if I seek a goal which does not put me into conflict with my tender needs, then I can be openly sexually aggressive. And so therefore, tenderness, sexuality, prostitution being one of the areas where sexuality without tenderness can be acted out. And this is one of the, I think, the cultural changes. Now, this reminds me, incidentally, as long as we're feeling a little bit in humor here, there's an excellent story, as you know, that illustrates this business, this relationship between tenderness and sexuality. This is a Viennese story, which was current about 1920, where there were two married Viennese gentlemen out on a party, and they went stag, and party was a very long party, everybody got well intoxicated, and the party broke up about 4 o'clock in the morning, and so the two gentlemen began to stagger home together, when one of the men got a sudden urge for sexual succulence. And so he turned to his partner and said, "Come, let's go to a prostitute." And the partner says, "Why, I'm ashamed of you, a respectable married man wanting to go to a prostitute." And the rejoinder says, why, you ask? Do you think I'd wake my dear sweet wife up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to save a few dollars? Well, I mean, this kind of This kind of different, you see. But obviously, there are cultural variations in all of this business about tenderness, sexuality, and incident. Speaking of Ford and Beecher's book, I may say that the one thing that I wish they had done in that book, it seems to me the one thing that is yet to be done, and maybe some anthropologists might still do this, is to now put the longitudinal patterns together. That is to say, they've broken it down into sort of cross-sectional ideas. Now, if we put the child-rearing techniques and the early experience with the sexual behavior in each culture and make a pattern of this, then I think we'd really have something. As it is now, it's pretty discreet. Now, of course, I suppose that they wanted to avoid all sorts of theoretical inferences, but this would not be a theoretical inference, really. Because if there's any relationship, for example, to learning, to associating biting and scratching and so on in sexual foreplay, there must be a whole personality configuration of material around the permissiveness of biting, scratching, what this means in the early child situation, its permissiveness and so on, is carried forward in the sexual act. So it would seem to me that if somebody would now do this, that is to say, make the patterns, consistent patterns of development from infantile to adult sexuality, then this would complete this study. And since they've done so much work, it would seem to me rather easy now to trade on that and go ahead and do this.
Yet, when she was given when she was told by the Nazi masters to beat her fellow prisoners, refused to do that. Mm-hmm. Is such conduct fit together?
Yes, I think so. That is to say that the flagellation, after all, even if one does it for money, must mean that there's some sort of gratification gets expressed too, perhaps hostility, and this could be done against people with whom you have no emotional identification. But toward people with whom you are emotionally involved, I think would be an inhibitory possibility there. Now, there may be many other reasons, too. I mean, it's very tricky to speculate about this. Incidentally, this brings to mind, I don't know what this association really means, it's only suggestive, but you know that after the Black Death and the various plagues in Europe, the flagellant sex increased a good deal, as did also anti-Semitism. It was as if there were two ways to handle the guilt evolved by counter-retribution from the world. One, to increase your own punishment. The other, to displace it and to make somebody else responsible for it. Now, whether that's just an accidental association or whether that can be linked up that way, this is always tricky when you pick up a few historical facts and put them together.
Of course, in connection with the Black Death and anti-Semitism, there's always the point that figures indicate that far fewer Jews were affected by it.
Yes. And of course, the cultural content of the myth of the negative stereotype of the Jew has changed. In the Middle Ages, he was the international sorcerer and magician. Now he's either an international capitalist or an international communist. See? So that there's even in terms of the content, he occupies the same dynamic position actually, but with the imago has changed. So.
Have you formulated your notions about the relationship between individual hostility and group violence?
No, not actually. The difficulty about that, of course, as I would see it, is that on the one hand it seems to be so obvious and yet really is so complex that either one dismisses it with a cliché or doesn't want to tackle the problem, actually.
Has there been any good work done along that line?
Well, there are some scattered articles, of course. Zilberg attempted to do something about it in one of the issues of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and I'm not sure exactly where that is. And I'm sure that there are other much more fertile and more inclusive sources, which at the moment I just can't remember.
Have you carried over into smaller groups the mechanisms, how they vary in size?
No. The whole question of prejudice, you see, what seems to be obvious in terms of hostility toward other groups, or at least in terms of prejudice, is that there is some identification made with some of the characteristics attributed to the member of the other group, and that therefore one reproaches the other person for having the very characteristics which the individual himself thinks are bad, and that therefore what is said about the in-group in terms of the charges that are made are dynamically interesting because they indicate the internalized charges the individual is making against himself. And this has been borne out by the analysis of about, some 20 or 30 people who had pronounced prejudice by Nathan Ackerman, who has written a good deal on this business of prejudice. Yes?
I was wondering, in societies where there is a minimum of hostility or aggression, there would also be a minimum of humor or a sense of humor among the people.
Well, that would be an interesting thing. You see, obviously the question, however, fundamentally is, it's awfully difficult to measure, let us say, we're just going to take how much aggression. Is this a less aggressive society than another? It's very difficult to arrive at that. And what is more profitable, I think, from the anthropological point of view, is to study ways in which aggression is handled, because the business of trying to assess more or less aggression is very deceptive, because you have this business between overt and covert, you see. And if, for example, the profitable thing there would be that it would be to assess the relative frequency and efficacy of various ways of handling aggression, and whether if you had high sorcery, you'd have low humor or something like that might be something that one would want to know. But I don't know about the other. Perhaps Dr. Linton.
I don't think you can answer that. You're dealing here with a series of axes. That is, you can have a society in which have a whole range from complete inhibition of overt physical aggression within the society to a relatively free play for it. In the same way, you could have, as I said last time, this matter of magic, the use of malevolent magic, and here you would have to, again, you have this axis, but you have to distinguish very sharply between what people say in their folklore of magic and the extent to which they really are anxious about it, believe in its practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, you can have a people who are highly aggressive outside the group, but who within the group never resort to physical aggression, at least. There are these possible intersecting lines, you see, on which you could spot a particular culture, but it is a combination of factors, sort of a forces pulling in different directions here.
Yes, I suppose that humor also depends upon some other things. For example, it certainly might very well depend upon the extent of verbalization somehow. That is, if we carry this thing seriously about the relationship between it and the dream work, well, then obviously what else is necessary is some high degree of storytelling facility, and this might vary from culture to culture also. Are there any studies about humor and
there have been a few exceedingly humorless discussions of our own society. But as far as I know, there are no cross-cultural studies of humor.
But as you suggested, it would be extraordinary. It would be the last thing you would get, because the nuance of language and so on, in order to understand.
Well, you very often, too, the point of a story is so completely culturally conditioned. Yeah. I remember, for instance, one of the favorite stories that the Bezalel told in Madagascar was a story of Anna Marina who came to the capital and wanted to get permission to trade for cattle, and went to the royal kraal, and asked to see the king, and was told that the king was down in his rice field. And he went down and saw an old man, very muddy old man, in a loincloth who was spading rice. He came up to him and addressed him by the disrespectful term of address that one uses to inferiors, and asked where the king was. The old man answered, "I suppose he's up in the palace where he belongs," and spat on his hands and went on with his work. So the mariner walked back to the palace a mile or so and was told, "No, the king's down in his rice field." And and then walked back again, you see, and this was the king.
Mm.
And the king then said, well, go on back to the palace. When I'm through, I'll come up. He did. He bathed and dressed in proper royal robes and so on and received this man. Well, now the joke of this is very, very funny. The joke of this is that this fool mariner didn't realize the king actually would be digging his own rice packs. That's what all normal human beings did.
Mm. Yes.
Isn't there a type of humor in us that isn't based on hostility or any forbidden impulsive like?
Oh, yes, there's that. Yes. You're thinking about puns, for example. Yes. The play on words. I think this has something to do with some of the residuals of the magic manipulation of reality and so on, which are holdovers from the child, perhaps. And just, whatever underwrites playing activity. That is a form. Let us say it's a play on words. We take that quite literally, and that therefore, after all, the manipulation of words is an important thing, and a little child gets a great deal of pleasure out of playing with words, making new words, and so on, and which I think that some people, for reasons of their own, maintain as adults. And frequently you'll find, for example, one of the truisms about the schizophrenic psychosis, not that punsters are schizophrenes, you understand, but is that they take the word overlay of reality which they've learned and work on the word as if it were reality. That is, in other words, they lose the connections between the word and the referent, and make strange words, change syntax, condensed words, and this is now a psychopathologic punning, but it is punning.
Why do people laugh at these puns?
Well, one of the ostensible thing is the element of surprise, for one thing, you see. It engages you, and then something not expected happens. That is to say, something unexpected develops, and I don't know exactly how to analyze this, but this is part of a good deal of humor, the unexpected climax. And it disappoints your expectancies and makes the world seem again a little uncanny, perhaps. And you could say that this might engender anxiety, and anxiety is discharged this way, I don't know. Or it might be just the glee that the rules have been suddenly suspended. I don't know.
Do you think these propositions about practices
child don't get any refund? And since you need, if you're going to have a wife, you have to buy another woman and so on. Well, this happens to you two or three times every time that there's a breakup of this sort. Cost of a wife and the quality of the accessible good, cost of the wife goes up and the quality of the available goods goes down. You don't get divorced, unless you're in one of the higher economic brackets. After all, you can realize that a very similar situation exists among ourselves. I have even heard a certain Protestant minister who was naive enough to point out the decrease in divorces that took place during the Great Depression as an indication that in the face of hardship, people were drawn together. of course, the thing that is wrecking marriage.